welcome to the Thoughtful Gamer Podcast, Episode 11. Today we have a very interesting episode where I have done an interview with designer Emil Larsen from Sun Tzu Games, where we're going to be talking about his game that's currently on Kickstarter, Burning Rome. I thought it was a great time. It's the first time I've done an interview like this, and I really enjoyed it. Probably even more than I expected. So I hope you find that enjoyable. Before we get to that, though, I just want to talk about some of what I've been playing. I'm alone here on the podcast today, just due to the fact that Orion is out of town and Matt couldn't make it. So I'm missing my usual contributors, but I was able to get a play of 1960, The Making of the President with Matt, which I got a few weeks ago, but haven't had a chance to play yet. It is by one of the designers of Twilight Struggle, Jason Matthews, with a second designer whose name I can't remember right now. And it is kind of a follow-up to that system in Twilight Struggle of kind of the card-driven war game with the added twist that if you play an opponent's event for operations, then their event happens. That's kind of the innovation of Twilight Struggle, and that's one of the reasons why it's my favorite game. And so I was very excited to see another game in this kind of very specific card-driven model. And it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with it. It's certainly not as tight as Twilight Struggle. It's not as intense. You don't have the positioning so much in terms of trying to avoid nuclear war, but also trying to figure out where the scoring cards are. It's a little bit simplified of a system, and the result is a much friendlier, more relaxed game. But it has a lot of the cool mechanisms that you would expect. It has the event cards, where you have to choose between the operations and the events. And it adds a few new things. So it's played over 9 rounds, and 2 of those rounds are unique. So the first one, which is round 6, I believe, is the debate. And then on round 9 is the election, which I guess is just kind of a final scoring round. You don't really make a lot of decisions there. And in the debate, you're basically throughout the game seeding cards into a stack that you will use in the debate, and that can help you win some free operations points, essentially. And then towards the end, you're seeding cards that you can use to try to swing states at the very last second in the election phase. But the other phases are, as you would expect, you draw a hand of cards and you play them for either operations or the event. Now, there are a few options on the operations. There's basically placing your political sway on the different, on the 50 states, which is handled similarly to Twilight Struggle. It's a little bit looser because you don't have any kind of penalty on turning opponents' influence until they hit 4 cubes in a state. Otherwise, it's just a 1-for-1 exchange, so it's a little bit easier there. And it also utilizes this system of mystery bag, is what I call it, where you have a bag that has both sides colored cubes in it, and then you pull out cubes to resolve things. So that will resolve who goes first in the round, who has the initiative in any given round. It also resolves things where you don't have an exact influence placement. So for example, if someone has 4 cubes on a state and you want to try to take away those cubes, you spend a certain amount of operations points there, or campaign points, I think they're called in this game, and you pull that many number of cubes out of the bag, and only the ones on your color actually count. So it's a neat little system for making things a little bit uncertain, and there are different systems in the game that will influence how many cubes you put into that bag. So that's a really, I found a pretty interesting mechanism to kind of play through. It also has probably my favorite part of the game is it has these two little subsystems that help you in kind of marginal ways, but don't help you directly. So you can spend operations or campaign points just to place cubes in states to try to win those states, but you can also place them on issues. There are 3 main issues in the game: civil rights, defense, and the economy. And those issues will give you kind of tangential benefits that will give you momentum, which I'll talk about in a bit, or they give you endorsements in different regions. And I completely underestimated the power of endorsements in my first game, and Matt won just because he had more endorsements. Endorsements basically give you the victory in a state if it's tied at the time of election. So if there are no cubes whatsoever on there, you will win the state if you have more endorsements in that region. So it ends up being very significant, because by the end of the game, like in the last couple of rounds, Matt had locked down endorsements nearly everywhere, and he was just following me around taking away the cubes that I placed, because he didn't need to get them to his side, he just needed to get them back to zero, and he knew he had the win in that state. So you gain those through the issue cards, and then you also have can have media presence in the different regions, or media influence, and that will take away those situations where you have to pull from the mystery bag. It eliminates that. And of course, both things will give you some bonuses on certain event cards as well. But I think it was really clever how those little kind of side mini games of tug and war played into the game as a whole. I found that very interesting. And I think that's probably the biggest strength of the game. Otherwise, it's just kind of a very simple back and forth area control game. But those add enough spice on top of the event cards to make it much more interesting than it could be. And then you have the momentum tokens, which are super interesting, because unlike Twilight Struggle, where if you play a card that has your opponent's event, their event happens automatically, in this game you have to spend momentum tokens if you want your event to happen when your opponent plays it. Furthermore, your opponent or anyone can play two momentum tokens when they play the card to prohibit that from happening. So there's a little subsystem in there that makes the game, again, a bit friendlier than Twilight Struggle, but adds a couple more, a few more interesting decisions along the way. I definitely don't think it's as good as Twilight Struggle, at least based on one play. The events didn't seem quite as specific or impactful as the ones in Twilight Struggle, and they had kind of weird conditions, so it'll be like, oh, if you have media presence in this region, place 5 influence in that region. They're kind of generic, whereas the Twilight Struggle ones are seem much more memorable and specific, which probably makes it easier to remember and also makes them more of a factor in the game, which ones you get. Plus, there's just less to memorize in Twilight Struggle because the cards are split up into early, medium, and late war. It's a lot easier to kind of grasp when the cards are going to come up and what cards you need to be focusing on. Whereas in this one, and in Labyrinth, which I'll be reviewing later this week, not only are there probably more cards than Twilight Struggle, but they're just all in one giant deck, which makes it, a daunting task if I was going to try to remember, the important cards in this game, because there are just so many and you don't have any indication of when they're coming up. In Twilight Struggle, you have little hints and little indications of when you can narrow it down in some instances where you know which cards are going to come up and play around that. And I think that plays to the strength of the game. In these, it's a little bit more loose in that regard. So I did find it a very pleasant experience. I'm very excited to play it some more and get kind of into the details a bit more, and hopefully not lose entirely on endorsements this time, because I completely underestimated how important those were going to be, and I want to actually win. So that's 1960, The Making of the President. This is the new edition from GMT Games that they just released on P500 a few weeks ago. And it's a beautiful package. It's probably my favorite GMT Games cover. Well, maybe. It's one of my favorites. It has the best, most clear rule book I've seen of any GMT game. GMT, if you've played any of their games, the rule books are very technically precise, but in some cases that can obscure the learning process of the game. So it's written like a legal document with subpoints and sub-subpoints and sub-sub-subpoints and all that, which is great when you want to reference parts of the rule book, but it also gives kind of equal weight to things that shouldn't be given equal weight. visually, and so it makes it hard when you're very first learning the game to understand how the significance of certain things, and I find it somewhat difficult. 1960 does a very good job of not only explaining things, it is a simpler game than most from GMT, but not only explaining things very clearly, but also explaining the importance of things. So it will go over, for instance, the media coverage or media influence aspect of the game, and then it gives a couple bullet points of what media influence in a region actually does. It doesn't hide that away in some other part of the rules like it would in a lesser GMT games rulebook. So well done there. It's an excellent rulebook and a really fun game. I can't wait to play it again. That's kind of the new game I played recently. We'll have this on the website at some point. Matt, as we may have talked about before, has every single Dominion expansion. We love Dominion, and he's been the one who has collected them all. In fact, there's a new one just released with vampires in it, I think. That's going to be interesting. But the problem when you get all these Dominion expansions is that it's great because you have all the cards and you can make any kind of setup you want, but it physically becomes a burden to actually play the game because you have to have some kind of organizational system, and then you have to find the cards and take them out and then put them back in the right spot. It's a headache, and so we haven't been playing that much Dominion. But I found some interesting storage solutions and sent them over to Matt, and he is in the process of printing out hundreds of these tabs that he's going to fit the cards into, and you'll be able to just pull out the tabs and have all the cards for all the kingdom cards in there and know exactly where they need to go and then be able to take them out and put them back in really neatly. And he says that he should, even with the new expansion that's coming out, be able to fit all of Dominion in two Dominion boxes, two of those normal size square boxes, which is just fantastic. And I cannot wait to play Dominion some more because, man, it's such a great game that we played a ton in college but haven't played that much since then. And I think this organizational solution will get us playing it more, especially because it's a really fast game we all like, and that's hard to find. Coming up for the Thoughtful Gamer, I am in the process of researching video equipment and more lighting and sound stuff to be able to do videos, which I'm very excited about. I'm also doing a bit of research into how to do some streaming on Twitch, playing board game-like games that are in the digital realm, as well as other things when I get around to it, because I do enjoy video games. And I think that'll be really fun to have streaming on a probably weekly basis, maybe once or twice a week consistently, and then every once when we're able to do it, to have actually gameplays streamed. So I'm getting some good lighting equipment to be able to light it well. I should be able to have two cameras going and do some live stream of some games, which I think will be really, really fun. So look out for that. I also want to probably record, live stream the podcast recording. I think that would be really fun. So you see kind of the original unedited version you can see in real time. I'll talk to the guys about that, but that's a goal to shoot for. So the Thoughtful Gamer is definitely expanding into the realm of video, and I'm very excited about it. If there's anything in particular you want to see when that happens, shoot me an email or contact me on Twitter or Facebook, and I would love to hear your feedback because I really want to play around with this a lot. I think it'll be a lot of fun. So with that said, let's transition over to the interview I had with Emil Larson. All right, I'm here with Emil Larson, the designer and publisher, I guess, of Burning Rome, which is on Kickstarter right now. We're going to talk a little bit about that game. And I'm going to have some questions about him, about Burning Rome, about the Kickstarter, about his background in board games, and it should be a good time. How are you doing today, Emil?
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me here. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Yeah, this will be fun. So just tell me a bit about the Kickstarter. It has just a few days left, right?
Yeah, we have like 8 days left, and we hit the goal like yesterday. So
oh, great. That's congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
And the game is, it's a tactical card game set in Rome versus Carthage and all that?
Yeah, it's set in the ancient world, ancient period of our time. So that's you know, you have you could call it a card game version of Rome Total War, the computer game.
Okay. Yeah,
there's probably some people who knows it. It's quite popular.
Oh, I love that game.
Yeah, me too.
It's a pretty quick game, right? About I think the description said about 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's a quick battle. You just play a single battle at a time, yeah.
Okay, tell me about the kind of the basic mechanisms of it. As I understand it, it's played kind of in three rows, and you're arranging your cards across the – or columns, I suppose. And you're arranging your cards across the columns to try to win those kind of three individual battles. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, you could say that. Like each army has three columns they can place their different units in, and you want to make a unit composition. You can put several rows, up to three units in each column. So you want to make a composition that beats the other column, and thereby dealing damage to the army itself, the opposing army.
Okay, and so it's really about kind of combining your cards successfully within each of the rows to get the most out of each unit.
Yeah, you could call it for those people who have played Magic or Hearthstone. You could say that you have several rows of minions. Mm-hmm. Here's just units from the ancient period that you try to place in the most optimal order, and you don't kill off the enemy units, but you try to deal as much damage as possible so that they cannot defend it, and the army itself will take the damage. So okay, that's how you try to align them in your favor.
Okay, so from like a thematic standpoint, you're kind of simulating kind of the front row clashes of the army and trying to win those individual skirmishes, and then any additional damage on top of that kind of goes to the rest of the army as a whole. That's yeah, unsimulated.
Yeah, yeah. You could say that you try to simulate that the units went up against each other here and there on the battlefield, and instead of having units go back and forth, and you just have damage that will go towards the army that is the hit points, and they're represented as just an amount of hit points. So kind of like the avatar of Hearthstone. You know, the hit points in Magic.
Sure, sure. And then you can also do damage, or you can, if I remember right, you can also do damage to the command points.
Yeah.
That's another factor to it, right? Explain that.
Yeah, the command points is a morale bar as well, and it's the way that you put units on the board. So it works as both a mana bar from Hearthstone or whatever, or the lands from Magic, and then it's also the morale of the total army. So while you want to spend it, you don't want to overspend it, so you get down where maybe a enemy tactic will push you off the command track and command point track, and then make your army flee. Mm-hmm. So in that way, you have two ways to defeat the opponent's army.
Oh, that's really interesting. I like games where you have multiple main avenues of victory like that, because I find it brings an interesting dynamic to trying to figure out where to put the pressure on, or taking advantages of weaknesses of one that might bolster the others. So that's super interesting to me.
Yeah, exactly.
And how much is it going for in the Kickstarter?
Well, it's only a £19, so it's like $23, $24 game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I've taken out the battle part of what was initially a bigger game, and made it available as you take four decks, and then you can play a lot and have a lot of these ancient battles and simulations, you could call them, and then you can do deck construction and just have quick skirmishes, or, you know, quick battles, as they're called. So you kind of have this Hearthstone-ish feel to it when you play this game.
Sure, yeah. And so it comes with, you said, four different armies?
Yeah. Yeah, four factions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any plans for releasing expansions in the future with more?
Yeah, definitely. I've actually, yeah, that sounds a bit ridiculous, but I've done some legwork in how I wanted the different factions to be presented. And I picked the 20 most iconic factions of that period. And then I divided them into like games of four. So they will come in 5 packages. That's the total vision. But of course,
That's
I'm focusing on the first one here and then the second one in line to see how that might unfold.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you got a lot of if this goes well, you got a lot more factions to put out. That's
Yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of like I want a lot of different abilities, but I thought it would be wise only to present three or four abilities in the first game and then present two or three in the next game, and you would have the different factions fight in very different ways because some of them would unlock new abilities that would be iconic for those games. And by making it standalone games, you can mix and match them as you want. So you could bring the third game in the line, and I could bring the first, and then we could have a clash between Egypt and Rome, or between Iceni and Greece, you know, both historical and non-historical clashes, right?
So it's planned out, so the upcoming expansions will they be more complicated in their design or just have different abilities? Or are you trying to
They will
keep it
mostly have.
simple?
Yeah, they will mostly have different abilities. Some of them might be a bit more complicated, but it's planned so that you could also take the second game and start from there. So it's not like you wanted to just grow in difficulty, but they will play very different. So, and also in this game, Carthage plays a lot different from Rome, because they were, you know, very different back then. So I wanted to be that everything is explained thematically, so it makes sense for players, and also it gives a historical plausible layout of how units interacted and fought. Because of course it cannot be complete simulations, then you would have a lot more details you would have to go into, but it needs to be also playable. So I want to
Oh, of
strike the
course, yeah.
balance that of course, also the computer game Total War series have done so many times, right?
Tell me more about this, the composition. I'm curious about how the different factions play. Tell me, like, for instance, like how what would the feel be different in terms of playing a Roman faction versus playing the Carthage faction?
The Romans play like most of their units can hold their own, because they were trained well. So they are solid all around units, and they have a bonus or benefit from having more siege heavy units. There are different stats on the cards that, you know, are then favored towards different factions, right? And they are, of course, the more siege heavy units, as they were very, very good at sieging enemies. Where Carthage, which was mostly made up of mercenaries, or in many cases, mercenaries and splendid generals like Hamilcar and Hannibal, and, you know, all those famous generals. So therefore, their deck have quite weak units combined with very heavy units like elephants and stuff like that. So there you want to play a more combo heavy deck where you have some units that you just play for their ability, and then you put down the heavy hitters like elephants and so on.
That's great. Now that's super interesting. I imagine it was fairly difficult to try to get the kind of thematic, you know, keeping the armies feeling real to how they were in history while keeping the game fairly simple. Was that a challenge?
No, not really. No, not really.
Great.
Because it's probably one of the things I've looked the most into, and what I've studied, you know, through my both my work and my as my hobby to study ancient war and stuff like that. So It was actually one of those things that came natural. When I was looking at the factions, I was like, okay, it makes sense that they can do this and they can do that, and they have a disadvantage in this area. And then I tried to pinpoint these different areas. Of course, it gets a bit more blurry the more factions you get, but there will still be some significant differences when you play like the Romans versus one of the other factions, which is Celtiberia, which is a Celtic or Iberian faction that fielded a lot of units trying to overrun the enemies, right? So it came quite natural that I like where I had to go with this.
I know you mentioned a couple times comparing this to like Magic or Hearthstone. Is that the kind of gamer demographic you're shooting for here? Is that the kind of people who will enjoy the game, or those who enjoy those kinds of tactical two-player games?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Of course, Magic can get very hardcore, and I'm not aiming for the top 5% who plays it on a, you know, a tournament level. That's not necessarily where I want to go, but I want those who get a kick out of creating small decks and you know, outsmart their enemies or opponents, you would call them. So that's the demographic, and that would be, you know, for Hearthstone or for Magic, those people who are in the middle.
Yeah, the people enjoy the format, enjoy that type of game, but haven't invested all their time necessarily into.
You can say I don't want to make it a collectible card game, so you can only have that many cards, and you know how when a new expansion or something is released for a new booster packs or released for Magic, how easily they are broken down because people invest so much money and so much time into them. And I only have 54 cards per faction. So of course the very hardcore gamers will be able to break it down easily and make some of the better decks. But hopefully by adding these other factions, there will always be a new way of playing. And there's a very specific other thing I've added to the game, you might say, and that's when you do deck construction here, you have a certain amount of points. So you don't build a pool of necessarily 20 cards. Mm-hmm. You build a pool of what the cards are worth plus the amount of army strength you have, like the hit points and the command points. So by adjusting those, you can either take out cards or implement cards, or and in that way it makes it very dynamic because you it would be like if you could ask the game in Hearthstone to reduce your life to 20 and then have a few more cards or a few less cards or something like that. So it gives you a completely other way of dealing with deck construction.
Oh yeah, that's fantastic. It's kind of similar to how miniatures games sometimes do it, but this is a little bit more involved. The card, when you say how much the card is worth, is that equal to how much it costs to play, or is it an independent value?
Exactly, that's the worth. That's how much it costs to play. That number you also use when you construct your deck.
Okay, fascinating. So it's almost like each card is doubled up on its command points because you're sacrificing a command point, you know, to have it in the deck, then it costs that much anyway. That's really interesting. I like that. And there's basically no minimum deck size.
There is on 8 cards, and it might go up to 10. I'm not sure, but it depends a bit, because if you make it so there is no limit, then people can make a deck where they can always draw the cards they want.
Right.
And you want there to be some uncertainty, like calculated uncertainty, right?
Right, exactly. So. Oh, that's really cool. That's a really, I think, a really neat innovation in deck construction. You said before that this was kind of the battle system of another game you were in the process of designing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit Pandora's box here opening. But the thing is that back when I played Rome Total War, I was initially so, you know, just dumbstruck by how awesome it was that I thought, okay, how can this be a board game? Like, it has to be able to be a board game. So I started working on it like 5-6 years ago, and I failed. And, you know, I put it aside. And then I actually started again Three years ago, and it was a runner-up for best board game in a Danish board game convention.
Oh, nice.
So that was very nice. And there it had a campaign map also. So you had the campaign map where you had some area control, moving your units around, and some worker placement on how you could use your different command points to spend on your army as a strategic view. And then when you ran into an enemy, either by skirmishing him or by sieging a city or by engaging in a battle, then you would go to this small battlefield where you will fight out the battle itself. And it has actually been quite successful from a review point, this part, but it was a hard sell to make. And at this point where games are getting shorter and shorter, or many games are, I thought it would be best to introduce people to the battle system, also because I could make it cheaper game, right, and a cheaper Kickstarter, and get it, you know, on people's radar, and then make a expansion of just the campaign map that would radically change the game, like make it a completely different game for those who want. So that would be like an insanely different expansion that you would usually, you know, see for a game like this. Yeah, so that was my way of easing into the big game.
Oh yeah, I think that's really smart. That's a great way of doing it, is, you know, getting the, especially when you're, you know, you're doing it kind of independently through Kickstarter, is getting the smaller product out first, you know, making sure people enjoy that, and then working your way up through the more factions into the campaign mode. That's great. Was there any part of the design when you were making the game that you enjoyed the most? From the way you talk, I'm guessing it might be the just adapting the different factions historically into the game, or am I wrong there?
No, but that's totally right. Like, I had the basics of the game, the combat system. It was done in a few days. Like, I just already had the idea of I want them to be able to support each other and then have the numbers combined and stuff. So from that perspective, it was refinement after first prototype. It was just, okay, this works. Mm-hmm. I just need to refine it and make it, you know, balanced and make it a bit more easy to do. And then it all came down to, okay, like, how do I make these factions represent themselves in a proper way? And the units, a good example would be the Romans Triarii, which is a unit, a troop definition, which was the third in line, the third infantry in line. Mm-hmm. So their ability would, for example, say that if you play this card, if you have more than two units in play, you would gain one command point. So it costs two to put it down, but you would get one back if you played it as the third or more card, which, you know, then it makes sense. If you deploy them as the first, then you are going against the historical simulation of the game, and you can do that, but it's with a small penalty, right?
Right, right.
And by understanding the history or how the game, how the units were used, you can, you know, be a bit better at the game, would be the short answer.
Oh, that's great. Anything you found difficult in the design? I know you said it was fairly intuitive to come up with it, but any troubles you had or anything you got stuck on?
Yeah, there's one thing, and that's how you place the cards. The way you overlay the cards and you add up the numbers is the one thing that everyone has said, there got to be some way to put the cards so you block out all the numbers, but only the visible ones. And There isn't, and it just, but it has taken such a long time to come up with the right icons and the right numbers and the right, like, placement for these numbers so that it looks and is fairly easy to do. And it seems like from the testing I've done that I've hit the sweet spot now.
So, okay, great. Yeah. So just kind of the graphic design of
yeah, the layout. Definitely. Okay.
Yeah, and this is your second Kickstarter, right? The second game you put on Kickstarter?
Correct.
The first one, as I was kind of researching, I saw it had a few delays on its release. What's your plan for kind of avoiding that fate with this game?
Yeah, a few is a bit of an understatement, but that's nice of you to say. I would say it's probably one of the most delayed Kickstarters in history that is actually delivering. So there is that.
That's good.
It is delivering, so it's currently being fulfilled, so that's really nice. And seeing how people are actually receiving it still is great fun. But one of the things is that the game is so much simpler. Like my first game had 70 unique plastic figures spread on 175 figures in a game and 400 unique cardboard components and stuff like that. So just cutting it down to 216 cards is an improvement. And then I've changed the manufacturer completely, and I've changed like almost every step of the way. And I've included the manufacturer, you know, way before I started the Kickstarter. And there's so just
been,
so many.
So you've been working with them, you know, working on getting it ready to go longer.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. I mean, I know it's got to feel awful to have a project that doesn't release on time, but it sounds like you've learned a lot from the experience, though.
Yeah, certainly.
Let's step away from the game itself, and I want to ask you a bit about yourself. Have you been playing board games a long time? Or it sounds like, obviously, you have played PC games like I have, but how long have you been playing kind of like modern board games?
Yeah, modern board games actually not that long. I would say, of course, it started with Catan because it has to.
That's what started with me too.
Yeah, it cannot be more than 7 years ago, I think, maybe 8 years ago.
Okay, yeah, that's not that long. I first played Catan too. Yeah,
and I am not the designer who played a lot of games. I played a lot of PC games, and I played an okay amount of board games, but nothing in comparison with most designers, I think.
Yeah, but I think maybe I'm just saying this because I haven't, you know, as a reviewer, I haven't played as many games as many other reviewers, so I'm kind of in the same boat here. But I think, you know, having the background in kind of strategy PC games can seems like it helps a lot. I was actually reading the other day, one of my favorite designers, Vlada Kovatel, actually started designing PC games before he transitioned into board games. So I think there can be a lot to gain there from understanding kind of the more intricate, sophisticated mechanisms that you can do in a PC game, and then kind of translating that into a more transparent and also simpler tabletop game. Have you found that's been an aid to you?
Yeah, certainly. Like, I mean, it's just many game designers will look at a mechanic and want to implement it, or, you know, start from a mechanic or a theme and look for mechanics. But I'm completely devoted to looking for an experience and then find the way out. Like, the experience is the only thing that matters to me. And I usually, when I start on a game design or something, I actually start with a video clip or something like that. So, for example, when I started on Burning Rome, the first thing I looked at was the intro to Gladiator. And we've seen it many times, right? And nice scenes, right? But that's where I wanted to go. I wanted, okay, this is the feel of weapons and how the different units fight. That's where I start from. And then I look at what kind of mechanics fulfill this, or can I just do some things? And then when I've done that, I will look into how do mechanics refine that. So I'm not very heavy knowledged on what mechanics do what, but I will reach out for them when I see the experience needs it.
I mean, honestly, I think that's probably the best way to go about it. First of all, I think because this is me just speculating. I think this is exactly the way I would design a game if I were to design one, because at the end of the day, like when I'm reviewing a game, I'm looking at the experience as a whole and then working my critique out from there. So I'm looking at, okay, how did this game make me feel? What kind of situations did it put me in? So if the designer is designing a game with that as the main focus, I think it probably helps the process, just because that's kind of that should be the proper end goal, and it helps kind of focus your values, I guess you could say, along the way. It's like, okay, you have a kind of a built-in litmus test of, you know, I could do this to the game, but does it help that experience I'm looking for? Yes or no? And you can kind of filter everything out through there. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I mean, mechanics, rule books, everything is just communication for you to get a player to experience this. And that experience might be something you've taken from a movie. It might be something you've taken from a personal experience or whatever. Like, those are just there as motors to get you somewhere. And I can never see a mechanic as the ending in itself. And that's probably also why I'm not so much a fan of engine building games, because they lean too much on the mechanic part and not on the experience part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's personal preferences, right?
Yeah, so you're more of a fan of the kind of the, I guess, what you call more thematic games. What are some of your favorite games, mm-hmm. by the way?
Yeah, that is probably revealed in my favorite games, because that would be something like Battlestar Galactica.
Mm-hmm.
Is a really cool game. Cyclades is a game I was inspired for my first Burning Suns game. Forbidden Island is a neat little game, a very pixelated Uncharted game, you might call it.
Mm-hmm.
that's probably some of the games I've had the most joy playing.
Yeah, that makes sense based on what you're saying. Particularly with Battlestar Galactica, it's one of my favorite games as well.
Yeah.
Where you have, I thought it was particularly clever, where you have the, you know, in that game you're trying to get the experience of working together but having some mistrust and doubt involved, and it's perfectly exemplified just by the skill check system, where everyone's working together to try to resolve something, but everything's placed face down. So you get the sense of working together, but also the sense of mistrust. And I imagine, who designed that? I think Corey Konietzka, maybe? Probably, if I had to guess, had the same kind of thought process in place of, I want to capture this feeling, and then trying to figure out how to do that.
And I think that's also apparent in many of the new games that has an IP, like Star Wars Rebellion, Star Wars Imperial Assault, which is all, you know, great games, right? And they capture the feel of the movies themselves much closer than you're used to.
Yeah.
So you can easily see that games are going that way, where they try to encapsulate the experience more.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a bit indicative of where we are kind of in modern board game history, where you have, you know, we have the Euro game Euro games coming to America, where they're a little bit more dry, less thematic, but they have all these really, really tight, good mechanisms, you know, in the 90s. And then kind of Americans getting on board with that, and then a lot of games out of America with a lot of theme. But it seems to me in the last 5 to 10 years, you know, it's kind of all blended together a bit, where you have a lot of thematic games coming out that borrow a lot from these really good Euro game mechanisms.
The worker placement is one of the real Euro mechanics that, when put into a proper game, can completely fade away, right? It's still there as a worker placement, but put in the right circumstances, it doesn't look like it, right? So.
Yeah, not in exactly, and you know, because it's just such a great, simple way of kind of introducing player interaction. And then you have games. Have you played Dominant Species?
Yeah, that's also a neat game.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and it, you know, it not only does it take kind of that Euro mechanism and put it into a heavily mean and combative game, but it also, I think, innovates on kind of the basic worker placement mechanism, where you have everything put out at first, and then it resolves all in a very specific order. So I think, you know, with board games, we're seeing kind of the best of both worlds coming forth, and I think that's really neat.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. Let's go down now to your day job, which sounds fascinating. You said you're in the military and you teach strategy?
Well, not strategy. That would be a bit much. I mean, I'm only a first lieutenant, so, you know. But I teach basic strategy or tactics, basic tactics for groups and for platoons. But I also do a lot of teaching on other things like planning and leadership and, you know, educating other people. So I do a lot of teaching people how to communicate. And how to win people over, how to inspire people, how to be a better leader, how to you know, a lot of those things that make for hopefully some of our leaders of tomorrow and such. So I'm here at the lieutenant school, mm-hmm. where I teach people who are coming from the sergeant class and will become second lieutenants and then go out to be platoon leaders. And that's really fascinating. Like, people are so engaged and people are, you know, willing to learn, and they, you know, have a big skill set compared to many others in the army. They're, you know, they're really peaking on that, right?
Okay. So nice. Have you found that your interest in board or computer games has helped you with your job, or vice versa? Has your job helped you with your designs?
Well, my job have helped me with many things in the way I structure my day, in the way I structure my designs, and the way I approach people, both business-wise and personally. And I think, no, certainly it's also the other way around. I'm pretty sure my students will say that I have a lot of interesting ways of teaching, and I put a lot of gamification in my teaching.
Oh, nice.
And a lot of ways of visualizing for people, like what they are going to do or see or learn. And I just found that it's one of the strongest way of communicating is to get people involved. And I've been planning some exercises for like 200 men. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, when you suddenly understand how games work and how you get people involved, when you take it out to, for example, an exercise size with 200 people running around doing different things, you suddenly understand how you make people stay in that world. I've had, groups lying and observing on everyone and everything, just to realize suddenly that some of them was just civilian, but they couldn't see the difference. They were so involved in the exercise that they could not just jump out and say, oh, okay, this is not part of it, or mm-hmm. you know. And that's fascinating, you know, when you can get people to be so invested in what you've put together that they don't lose grasp of it, even though they see civilian cars and stuff coming by here and there, right?
Right.
So,
That's completely fascinating. I had my previous job, I got to manage people. I never managed people before, and it was a ridiculous learning experience for me because I'd never been put into that position. And I very quickly found that I'm not the best, like, people person. And I thought, okay, I'll just, you know, I'm good at making decisions, so I'll make good decisions. And I very quickly found that, you know, to lead and to be effective in managing and leading people, you have to not only make the right decision, but you have to figure out how to communicate it, which took a long while for me to figure out. So it's an incredibly valuable skill.
Yeah, certainly. And I believe what you're doing now, like, podcasting is also communicating in a specific way. It's also pushing that skill tree.
Right. Yeah. Communicating effectively. And I think, you know, if you do it with games, one of the things I did a lot of debate when I was younger in high school and college. And one of the things I learned very quickly was that I got it from a book. I can't remember the name of the book right now, but the idea of schemas. Is the way they phrased it, where you want to explain things where it creates an image in someone's mind, because images mm-hmm. are a lot easier to remember than just words and concepts generally. And so, you know, that's like one level of it, but actually making a game and putting people into the experience of it is like a whole nother level of schema there.
Yeah. And often you have to look at it from the other perspective and say, okay, I have some schemas that put people in it, but where are the points where they're pulled out? Mm-hmm. Because it's easy to identify what is cool and what is thematic and what makes people feel a special way, but it can be hard to identify where are certain points where people are suddenly pulled out and it's like, hey, that doesn't make sense, or that doesn't fit in here, and mm-hmm. yeah.
I find this endlessly fascinating, so I'm going to pry into your job a bit more.
Sure.
Would it be accurate to say to boil it down, kind of, that you're teaching people to make the right decision and also communicate? Is that kind of the two main things that you're teaching there in terms of like teaching leadership and tactics and decision making?
Yeah, that's not completely besides. I teach people to communicate and to make and plan this good decisions,
mm-hmm.
and then to have other people go and do it, and then figure out how do you both live with it, because that's the other consequence,
sure.
living with doing a specific thing when we talk the army, right?
Right, right.
But also like just how do you deal with people, both having constraints but also have freedom to do specific things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very enlightening to work with, because you get to see many different sides of people. People who are very, very engaged and very knowledgeable when you sit at a desk, and then suddenly you put them in the mud somewhere, and then they have to find the same knowledge and now communicate it while they're under fire, and it's raining and it's the fourth day in mm-hmm. In the mud. That takes a completely different skill set.
Right, right.
So merging those together and make for whole citizens and whole leaders, right?
Right, right. That's I think that's such a cool thing you're doing there with, helping people make those kind of decisions and work in those kinds of situations. That's absolutely fascinating to me. Man, I guess that's pretty much all the questions I had. This was really fun.
Yeah, it was.
Great. And you said you have just a few more days on the Kickstarter?
Yeah, 8 days.
8 days is of this, now, so yeah. When the podcast goes up, that'll be 6 days left. I'll make sure to put the link to the Kickstarter in the podcast description, so
people
can go check it out there. Thank you very much for coming on with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Any plans for other designs after Burning Rome? Or are you going to stick with just focusing on the expansions for this game, or anything brand new?
Well, I do have some other things burning, cooking, whatever you would call it.
Sure,
so
yeah.
I do have some other, both historical, and I want to expand the Burning Suns universe. So we've also published a few books in the Suns universe. So mm-hmm. yeah, I'm trying to embrace the experience and the universe as much as possible.
That's fantastic. Well, again, thank you for coming on. This is Emil thank Larson you. With Sun Tzu Games. Again, check out that link at the bottom if you're interested in the Kickstarter. It just has a few days left. So if you're interested, click on it now and keep in touch, Emil. I'm very interested in playing and reviewing the game when it does come out. So I'm excited.
Cool. Thank you. I'm glad to have been here.
Thank you. Well, I had a lot of fun with that interview. It was great doing it, and I'm surprised the connection worked as well as it did. I was a bit scared at first because I hadn't done one over Skype before, but the quality came through quite well, and I'm excited to do more of these. If you're a designer, if you know a designer who'd be interested in this kind of thing, don't hesitate to contact me, because I love interviewing, and I like picking people's brains about the design process and kind of their philosophy and how they make games and how they conceptualize and think about these things, because that really fascinates me a lot, looking really deeply into the design process and the way that people make board games. So I definitely want to do more of these, and I'll be on the lookout for more designers to interview. Let me know what you think of it. I think it's a really fun thing, but if I get a lot of feedback saying, no, we don't want more interviews, I'll take that under consideration. I really want to hear from you guys. That's our podcast for today. Thanks for listening. Make sure to check us out at thethoughtfulgamer.com. Also hit me up on Twitter or Facebook, and don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this from, and I'll talk to you again soon. Goodbye.